From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The national parks have been called America's best idea. The most special places across this country protected for everyone forever. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. From Acadia to Arches, Joshua Tree to Zion, the parks and the connection with the wild they provide are more popular than ever. But the parks also face big challenges. Outside Magazine has devoted its May issue to a deep, wide exploration of the national parks. Their writers, join us this hour on Point, making the most, respectfully, of the national parks. You can join us as well, on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Give us your best story of the national parks, the moment, the trail, the view, and if you must, give us your worst story, what happened. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In 2009, Ken Burns' documentary, The National Parks, Teddy Roosevelt here, voiced by Kevin Conway, describes his experience camping under the sequoias of Yosemite with famous naturalist John Muir.
Lying out at night under those sequoias was lying in a temple built by no hand of man. And I hope for the preservation of the groves of giant trees, simply because it would be a shame to our civilization to let them disappear. We are not building this country of ours for a day. It is to last through the ages.
Through the ages. And here, John Muir, voiced by Lee Stetson. This is from Muir's autobiography, published in 1913. Well, you'll get the idea.
The tendency nowadays to wander in wilderness is delightful to see. Thousands of tired, nerve-shaken, over-civilized people are beginning to find out that going to the mountains is going home, that wildness is a necessity.
There's the Ken Burns sound of thinking about the national parks. Here's a different from the scene, a scene from Rock the Park. It's a show that follows friends Jack Stewart, Colton Smith. They explore every national park across the country. And here's the pair and their crew encountering a grizzly bear right off the trail at Glacier National Park in Montana just last November.
Oh, my gosh. Guys, hurry up. Hurry up. We got to go. There's a bear that's really close to us.
Whoa.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, so we have a grizzly bear. We've got a big grizzly bear.
Here he comes. Right down there.
Hey, bear!
Trying to shy him away from the trail.
Ew.
Wow, this is so cool.
Hey, bear, and you are in the national parks. We're looking at how they're doing and how to make the most of them, maybe to get you into some mountains and valleys and ranges and glens and meadows that you may not know about. Folks from Outside Magazine are going to help us do that. Joining me now from Durango, Colorado, is Kate Sieber, correspondent for Outside Magazine, contributor to National Parks Magazine. Kate, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
With us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Grayson Schaefer, senior editor and staff writer at Outside Magazine. Grayson, welcome to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Kate, get us right into the thick of it. We've got big issues to look at, but we want to savor this. We want to feel it. I'm looking down a list of more than two dozen national parks that you've been to. Take us to a great moment. Anyone you like, Kate, in your time in the parks. Place us somewhere. Help us feel it.
Well, one of my favorite national parks is actually Wrangell St. Elias, which is in Alaska, and it's actually the biggest national park in the whole system. It's larger than the country of Switzerland.
Okay.
And one of my favorite trips...
This is Alaska, right?
In Alaska.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite trips was I did an exploratory trip with a guide and a photographer, and we basically got dropped off in the middle of nowhere. The guide had flown over the area but had never been down in there, and our job was basically to walk our way out. And we encountered grizzly bears and bushwhacked through thickets of willows and staggered through icy, raging rivers. And it was just an incredible experience just being in such a gigantic landscape. And essentially remembering your own unimportance in a way is really, it's really connecting and really restorative.
I don't have Wrangell, but here's the sound of a mother grizzly bear catching silver salmon for her cubs in Lake Clark National Park in Alaska. Here's the sound of the bears feeding. And again, we're in the national parks. Grayson, there is a kind of debate going over, there are many debates around the national parks, but one of them is how to use the parks. You've got a generation coming up that wants to, just be out there everywhere. Another generation that might just climb in the car and roll down the roads in the national parks. What is this debate about how they ought to be used and accessible?
Yeah, this is the sort of this is the sort of central dual mandate of the national parks. You know, the parks were established. The Park Service was established in 1916 by the Organic Act that sort of gave them this mandate to preserve the parks unimpaired for the benefit of future generations. And so the Park Service for the last 100 years has had to sort of balance these two opposing forces, which is to one, leave the parks in this pristine state, this idea of wildness that we always hear about, what Kate was talking about, being able to be dropped off and to be a visitor on the landscape, to be in the bear's territory and meeting the animals on their terms.
Yep.
And then this idea of the enjoyment of the people. And that's where the Park Service has, had to build roads and bathrooms and visitor centers and sort of figure out how to accommodate in many cases, millions and millions of people each year who want to enjoy these parks and see the wildlife and go and have amazing adventures in the parks. And, I think that they've been trying to balance this. More recently, people who read Outside Magazine, who want to be mountain biking and road biking and in some cases even, base jumping and hang gliding and paragliding, doing all these sort of extreme sports.
Yes.
They look at the national parks and see, the most amazing landscapes, the best places to do these things. And those two opposing forces come into conflict.
What's the limit there? Does the National Park Service not allow people to go out and engage with their terrain? I know you can't just head in there with all-terrain vehicles, go roaring through, but can you not either rappel any rock face you like or take your mountain bike wherever you want?
No, and that's the thing. The national parks are incredibly sensitive areas, and in many cases, for Yellowstone, for example, is the most intact ecosystem left in America. And so in a lot of these cases, these are incredible refuges for wildlife. These are really sensitive landscapes where endangered species live. And so it's really important for the Park Service to be, protecting and making it pretty difficult to do a lot of the activities that you like to do. But that doesn't mean that you can't do it. And so what we did with this national parks issue was to figure out a lot of the amazing adventures that you can have in the national parks. Because one of the things, I think, if you were just to go to a national park and go blind, go cold,
yep,
go to a visitor center and see what you could do, for the most part, what you're going to end up having happen is that you'll get funneled into these sort of scenic loop roads. You'll drive to pullouts. You'll view the park sort of through the plexiglass. People talk about it at national parks as a kind of diorama. And it turns out, though, that there actually are amazing adventures that you can do in national parks. And so that was really our goal, was to figure out how to help people, find these things that really aren't advertised. And that's, with good reason. The Park Service, doesn't need to have, more search and rescue missions or, having people who are unprepared, getting themselves into trouble. So it turns out, though, that there actually are amazing adventures that you can do in the national parks.
307 million people visited the national parks last year. 1929, it was 3 million. That's a lot, biggest number ever. But Kate, what about these amazing adventures that you may not know about if you're just headed for the loop road? And of course, that can be beautiful, but give us a sense of what's out there. What are the options? What can be done? What and where, Kate?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing a loop road, especially if you have mobility issues or that kind of thing. But there's so much more out there. And, one thing that I like to think about is places that you might not immediately associate with national parks, like underwater places. There's great snorkeling and diving. And
where?
Biscayne and Dry Tortugas in Florida. Those are amazing parks. There's also great diving in Channel Islands National Park, which is in California. And they have these incredible kelp forests with seals and fish and all sorts of things that you can explore there. There's also in Everglades National Park, also in Florida. You can do canoe trips between platforms and camp out in these swamps and watch alligators and wake up to birds and that kind of thing. There's also, even in Yosemite Valley, you don't necessarily have to have, special skills to just rent a little ducky and float your way down the Merced River in the Yosemite Valley and just be watching El Cap and these amazing monuments float by. So there's lots to do. It's sort of endless.
We're going to get deeper and deeper in there. Here's a little bird song from the Channel Islands National Park you just mentioned in California. Sound of newborn baby puffin broadcast through a live cam there. A lot of people, even just on those webcams now, watching what's going on in the parks. Grace and Kate, stand by. Chris is calling from Akron, Ohio. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What's your story?
So when I was 16 years old, my parents took my cousin and I out to Yellowstone National Park. And my cousin and I stumbled across a book in a bookstore called Death in Yellowstone. And we bought it. And it actually just chronicles all the weird ways that people had died in the park, from falls to bears to geysers, or hot springs and things like that. And it was just a very weird introduction to the national park system.
Did it scare you away, Chris?
It did not. My cousin and I went back to Glacier National Park this past summer and had a blast. So.
And you know that the Death in the Park series has become so successful that there are actually dozens of volumes of this now for multiple national parks. It's sort of this strange phenomenon, people reading, wanting to read about death in the park.
And you've got this amazing story of the tragic death of, I think it was 7 in the Keyhole Canyon in Zion National Park. We'll talk about that, Grayson. But, I mean, what a flash flood. They were down in some of that amazing stone and just got into big trouble in a hurry.
That's correct, yeah.
So the adventures are there. Kate, do you feel watched over when you're in a national park by the rangers and all the rest? Does it feel more comforting that way? Is it pure wild or not?
It depends on where you are and how far out there you want to get. If you're going out into the middle of the Alaska wilderness, there's really no one who's going to be watching over you except yourself.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound there of waves breaking at the easternmost national park in the United States, Acadia in Maine, absolutely gorgeous. We are talking this hour about really getting into our national parks, the mountains, valleys, hidden gorges, new trails into national parks as the National Park Service turns 100 this year, giving you some new compass settings here, well, GPS coordinates for this summer maybe. What national park adventure have you most loved? Where could you use some advice? Our friends from Outside Magazine are here. Grayson Schaefer, senior editor there, staff writer. Kate Sieber, correspondent who has been all over more than 24 national parks she has visited. You can join us as well with your story. And many are lined up to do just that. Tony in Atlanta, Georgia. Tony, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What's your story, Tony?
Well, a little bit of a different twist on the conversation here. My memory of a national park visit ended up in me getting sober. And I wanted to share that with everybody out there.
Where were you coming from? Where did you go to? Where were you? What? Tell us.
I was in Midtown Manhattan, a young, successful, cocky Wall Streeter type person, and ended up in a bender out to the Grand Canyon and took the mule ride down to the bottom, spent a couple of nights, and that's where I hit rock bottom, as they say. My last beer was at Phantom Ranch. It's been 25 years. I'm grateful for the national parks and sobriety.
Did the setting have something to do with your turnaround? Grand Canyon's about as awesome an environment as you can ever find.
Absolutely. If you don't stand on that rim and feel insignificant and realize that there's something more powerful out there than you, I don't know what's wrong with you. It's just an amazing experience. I've been to several parks since then. I adore them. I support them. I don't know what else to say, but thank you for the national parks.
Tony, we love your call from Atlanta, and hitting rock bottom at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, there's something that all fits together about that. Here's the sound of, maybe we'll take you back, Tony, birds at sunrise, South Rim, Grand Canyon. Grayson, have you seen this effect on people? They go to the national parks and they find that thing that John Muir was saying we need, that Tony found.
Yeah, I think it's hard to go to a national park without feeling this sort of sense of wonder. I mean, a lot of the national parks that we have, I think, are created as a result of people having, you know, of leaders having regrets over things that were destroyed. For example, like Hetch Hetchy, next to, you know, the next valley over from Yosemite, that you know, John Muir always sort of had this regret this valley was destroyed, and so Yosemite was
dammed
preserved
as a water source
for San Francisco.
Francisco.
Mm. So right, so you know, and we have Glen Canyon Dam put on the Colorado. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that in a lot of cases, it's a matter of preserving the things that we have left. And in the U.S., we've had this sort of great foresight early on to preserve a lot of these landscapes before there was massive amounts of development encroaching from all sides as there is now.
I mean, you go all the way back. What it was back in Civil War time that Yosemite was put under protection by Abraham Lincoln in Congress then, and then President Ulysses S. Grant made Yellowstone America's, and I'm reading here, the first truly national park. I mean, this was a breakthrough, not to mention by the time we get to 1916, the origin of the centenary we're celebrating now, when finally the National Park Service came in and brought some order to the national parks. All kinds of things were going on. Kate, you've been in so many. When you heard Tony in Atlanta saying, you know, he got to the bottom of Grand Canyon and there hit bottom and sobered up, that kind of almost spiritual response, certainly deeply resonant response, can happen in many places. Among all these that you visited, Denali and Glacier and Grand Teton and, I mean, Mesa Verde and on, where have you seen people find that kind of deep resonance in nature, Kate?
You know, I think that different parks elicit those responses in different people. I actually love Tony's story because I really relate. I'm not sober necessarily, or I'm not an alcoholic, but I go to the Grand Canyon regularly. It's not too far from my house, really, and I try to actually go to the North Rim every year just because it's so restorative. And
that's not the settled rim. That's the more rugged rim.
That is a very rugged rim, yes. There are some visitor services over there, but the vast majority of visitors go to the South Rim and very few go to the North Rim. And typically you need to be ready to be a little bit uncomfortable if you're going to go for a hike over there, because it's pretty steep and it can be exposed and pretty hot, depends. But it's completely worth it and so beautiful. And you get into these places where you're the only person there, and it really can be a pretty spiritual experience.
Can you drive in close enough to walk in, or do you have to walk in for miles, or can you bike in? What's the access like on the North Rim?
Well, usually where I go, there are trails, oftentimes you have to access them with a four-wheel drive road. Typically, you can get pretty close to the rim, and then you might hike a mile or two to the rim and then head over, and then it typically goes straight down. And so, for example, last year I went on the Thunder River Deer Creek Loop, and it's actually a vertical mile from the rim down to the river. You have to be ready with your trekking poles or have your knees in pretty good shape to do that kind of thing.
I would guess so. Grace in Montreal, Canada. Grace, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What's your story?
Great show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to recount the experience I had in university with my two roommates. We got a pass for the national parks and set off from the East Coast sort of through a southern route and stopped in, camped out in many of the national parks. And just what an experience it is. And it's just, I mean, it makes you think that you're on many planets all in one country.
Paint some pictures for us, Grace. Where were you? Which parks were you in? What moment do you remember?
So, it was Carlsbad Caverns, and then went White Sands, New Mexico stands out as one in particular that just we felt like we were on Mars or something. I mean,
Describe it. We haven't all been there. We're not all as lucky as you on that one, Grace. Describe it for us.
No, it was amazing. It's Bryce Canyon, and we didn't go to any of the huge, I think the really popular ones, but sort of traveled a line in the Southwest, and what a country we live in, and the amazing geography, it was an experience.
We hear it. Grayson, what's your favorite, just for natural, gorgeous beauty?
I mean, I think what Grace is talking about is really important in that, you know, we think of national parks, and we think of Yosemite and Yellowstone and Zion and all these sort of the big iconic ones, but there are actually, you know, there are 59 national parks, and I think the current count for national monuments and historical sites is up to, I think,
almost
411 total. And so places like White Sands National Monument down in southern New Mexico, it's this sort of white gypsum sand that's even in the bright sun and the heat of summer is cool on your feet, and you can sort of walk across these bleached white sand dunes like Lawrence of Arabia and have these sort of amazing experiences where there really aren't that many people who are out there with you. You can have this sort of sense of solitude if you go to – know, some of the parks and some of the monuments that aren't the big iconic ones. And then, you know, if you add to that, if you go in the off season, if you go, you know, in April and May as things are warming up, or go in September, mm-hmm. October as things are cooling down, you can have this sort of amazing solitude, you know, off the beaten path.
Kate, you can backcountry camp in White Sands. I think you said there's even sledding there. What does that look like?
Yeah, that's really, it's really fun. You can actually rent a sled there and basically climb to the top of the biggest dune you can find and sled right down it, which is really fun.
That sounds wild. How do you camp in sand, in pure white gypsum sand? Do you actually drive tent stakes in there?
Well, actually, you can walk out, and in between the sand dunes are these valleys that are much harder in terms of their surface.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pitch a tent out there. You don't typically even need a tent because it's pretty rare for it to rain.
Oh, that
down
sounds
there.
Great. So just so, have your sleeping bag and roll out under the stars.
Exactly.
You've described White Sands as almost like a mini Galapagos. What do you mean by that? Galapagos is islands where you can find rare, unusual, maybe unique creatures. White Sands?
Yeah, so White Sands, because of its unique environment, there are all these creatures that have adapted, and you can find white mice there and white lizards and white crickets and white spiders. It's quite remarkable.
Everything white living in the White Sands. I love it. That's pretty amazing. Dawn in Green Township, Ohio. Hi, Dawn. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted everyone to know that if you are 62 years of age, you can apply for a one-time fee of $10 to the National Park Service online or actually at the park.
Okay.
And that gives you a lifetime pass to enter the park. They give you a card to keep in your wallet as well as a placard you can hang. So once you pay that one-time fee of $10, you can enter any national park for free, as well as up to three people within your car with you as well.
That has to be the best deal in the universe, Dawn. That sounds like the best bargain I've ever heard of.
Best deal. It is. It's wonderful. And so we use that as our vacation destinations. And also, if you want to camp, it's in Acadia National Park, it's only $6 to camp there.
Wow.
It's very, very, very affordable. And we drive sometimes to our destinations. Sometimes we'll fly halfway and then rent a car and drive and hit two or three parks. And it's very, very, very affordable and wonderful.
I'm glad you remind us of that, because that these days, that's a real blessing and really something to keep in mind. Take us to a moment that you've most loved or a park you've most loved on.
Oh, hands down, Sequoia National Forest. It's something that is so majestic and makes you feel so small when you stand underneath those trees and just stand in the forest that way. It's just absolutely beautiful.
Oh.
The other thing, though, is it makes you in touch with the areas that are around there, because in those areas they haven't had rain in 4 years.
Yeah.
So you get an education on what's going on with the people around the parks as well as in the park.
There's a lot to feel and a lot to learn. California's been dry for a while. Dawn, I'm so glad for your call. I really appreciate you calling in with that. Let me get one more. Plattsburgh, New York. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a unique experience. I was a seasonal park ranger for North Cascades National Park in Washington State. And
cool.
It was really quite an experience, probably shaped my whole life. But you were talking about John Muir and how it was a spiritual experience. And I was lucky enough to spend a lot of time out there. And I know what he's talking about.
Take us to it. Put us in a setting where you felt that awe, Jim. What did it look like there in the North Cascades National Park, Washington State?
You're just surrounded by a sea of mountains, and you feel pretty small compared to, you know, the whole universe out there. It gives you a whole nother perspective versus your everyday life. So it's the parks are immensely special, and you know, America, we are very, very lucky to have them.
We are blessed, and blessed that a century and more ago, people said, let's hang on to this. Well, look at how we're doing on taking care of those parks now. Just heard there from Jim, who worked as a seasonal ranger in North Cascades National Park in Washington State. Jody in Bristol, Connecticut. Jody, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm great thinking about all these parks. I'm kind of floating here.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's an amazing experience, for sure.
What do you know?
I had a unique experience. I took my children for an entire summer. We traveled from Connecticut to California and back, and we covered 30 national parks.
Oh my! How many miles was that?
Way too many to count. It was ridiculous.
You have incredible endurance. Out of all that, what most struck you, Jody?
Seeing my children see it for the first time and what they've taken from it. It's been 9 years now, and my daughter wants to be a national park ranger, and she still talks about it daily.
How did they engage with the parks? How old were they, and what did you find the best way to have your kids engaging with the parks?
They were 11, 9, and 7 at the time.
Okay.
And I think the most underused and undervalued part of our parks is the park rangers. And they have park ranger programs where it's different in every park, and sometimes they talk about the botany and the flora and the fauna and the safety, and there's different topics they cover, but every time you go in there with your child, they actively engage them in getting to know the park that they're in. And whether it's talking about, you know, a sheep that is natural to the environment or a tree, they have to go through a program, and it's kids age-oriented, but they have to pick up garbage in the park, and they sit through a ranger program. And when they go through all of these things, they earn a badge, a junior ranger badge. And my kids have a ranger hat covered with 30 badges.
You're a heck of a mom giving your kids that experience, and they must have felt great. The junior ranger program, that's useful for listeners who may be taking their own kids. Jody, I really appreciate your call. Wow, 30 national parks in one summer. That's really getting into it. Kate, Grayson, please stand by. I want to welcome in another Outside Magazine editor. Axie Navis joins us, also from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Axie, hi. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So where have you been lately in the parks, Axie?
Well, you know, I grew up in Colorado, and I have spent a lot of time in Rocky Mountain National Park. That will always have a special place in my heart, mostly because I think it epitomizes that classic Colorado beauty with big peaks, some of which are over 14,000 feet, many of which top out above tree line, and it's just that raw, rugged, natural beauty.
415 square miles. That is a big park. How do you engage with it? How do you get into it? Give us a way to do it well.
Well, the classic route through Rocky Mountain is Trail Ridge Road, which is a paved road that tops out above 12,000 feet. And if the only thing that you do in Rocky Mountain National Park is drive that road, you will come away astounded. There are lots of other ways to get into the park, though. A lot of trails. It's bisected by lots of trails. You can climb up to Long's Peak, which is one of the biggest mountains in the state. And you can also get on a lot of back dirt roads, either on your bike, which is something that I have done frequently, or in your car, or hiking. And that's, in my opinion, the best way to see the park, because it leaves behind a lot of the traffic.
Tell us about those. I mean, they've got this famous Trail Ridge Road at Rocky Mountain National Park, but you write also about the Old Fall River Road. What's that?
Old Fall River Road parallels Trail Ridge Road, and it was a road I actually just discovered this season, or rather last fall. And it was stunning. The leaves were changing. The elk were in the middle of their rut or their mating season. So I started low, rode through these beautiful, lush, green valleys, and then top out above 12,000 feet on this dirt road. And in this case, I was on a bike. So as soon as you enter Old Fall River Road, which, like I said, runs parallel to Trail Ridge, you leave behind a lot of the cars and a lot of the people that come and visit that park. And it's a really magical, awe-inspiring experience.
Axie Navis in there. I'm reading here. At the end of 6 hours, she says, my Garmin read 83 miles and 7,300 feet of elevation gain. A true epic. This is in Rocky Mountain National Park that fully justified the fajitas and margaritas at Ed's Cantina and Grill that night. I'd say so, Axie. I'm glad you're here with us. Please stand by in Santa Fe, and Grayson Schaefer there as well. Kate Sieber in Durango, Colorado. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking about the national parks this hour. It is the centennial year, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the National Parks Service. And we're joined by people from Outside Magazine. They've been all over the national parks of this country, written about it quite wonderfully in their May issue. Kate Sieber is with us from Durango, Colorado. Grayson Schaefer and Axie Navis from Santa Fe, New Mexico. These are people that know, you may well know a lot as well, and we want to hear your stories. What was your favorite national park moment, view, experience, smell, sound, spiritual awakening if you're in that John Muir camp. And what about the way we're caring for our national parks today? Gus says, I flew to Colorado with a few friends, hiked Mount Zirkle for about 3 days. Didn't get off the trails, but it was quite the trail for a bunch of city folks from South Florida. You feel insignificant, full of life, connected to the beauty of the earth. Made me appreciate the beauty of our own national parks and forests, the fragile and endangered Everglades in Florida, Gus says. And Paul writes, we've camped in many of the national parks, backpacking the Grand Canyon, amazing. Also met many day hikers who were totally unprepared, hiking in street shoes, no water, food, or supplies. Park rangers then have to drag these people out after they get in trouble. So respect the parks. This is real, serious, big-scale nature. Here's a group of tourists watching Old Faithful erupt at Yellowstone. And here, Yellowstone wolves. They're on the Blacktail Plateau in Wyoming. Grayson, we've heard so much about problems with upkeep of the national parks and their budgets. A $12 billion backlog now of needed maintenance and repairs that are not being made, haven't been anyway. Is that immediately evident when you hit the parks, Grayson?
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of these things are kind of hidden. The landscapes themselves are sort of the most noticeable things in the parks. But, you know, the annual Park Service budget is just under about $3 billion. This year, for the first time, Congress, you know, for the first time in a long time, Congress actually made a healthy appropriation for the parks that will help, you know, clean up some of those backlogs. They've had some new programs that they're trying to use this year. For example, the Every Kid in a Park, which is allowing every fourth grader in the U.S. to and their families to have free admission to all the parks. So Jody, who called, you know, talking about bringing her 7, 9, and 11-year-olds into the parks. I mean, those are the sort of the key ages to get people engaged, you know, to have these sort of, you know, life shaping experiences where, you know, this the idea is to sort of create the next generation of, you know, park enthusiasts and park supporters. And that, it turns out, is one of the sort of key ways that the parks actually are funded and supported is by these sort of friends groups, like the National Parks Conservation Association and other nonprofits that sort of provide private support for, you know, to fill in some of these budget shortfalls that aren't being funded by Congress.
We had Interior Secretary Sally Jewell talking just last week about funding and development problems facing the national parks. She painted a pretty bleak picture of the future.
If we stay on this trajectory, 100 years from now, national parks and wildlife refuges will be like postage stamps of nature on a map. Isolated islands of conservation with rundown facilities that crowds of Americans visit like zoos to catch a glimpse of our nation's remaining wildlife and undeveloped patches of land.
Postage stamps of nature on a map. What is she talking about, Grayson? Is this about development around the parks? What's the threat?
That's right. The biggest threats to the parks these days are actually it's this idea that a park is not just sort of where you draw the boundaries on the map. It's about park ecosystems. And the ecosystems for most of these parks, the animals that live within them, mm-hmm. Don't just live within the park boundaries. They migrate in the winter. You know, elk herds will migrate down to lower land in the winter for food and forage. Bison are migrating out of Yellowstone. Elk herds in a lot of these different parks are moving, and a lot of different animals are moving. And what happens is that they move onto private land around the parks. Those are ranches. And in a lot of cases, those, you know, those areas are subject to development. They're subject to the economic forces of the private economy. So you have ecosystems being broken down. You know, antelope herds that are trying to migrate are now trying to migrate through oil fields and subdivisions and that sort of thing. And then you also have this sort of crush of development that is trying to get in on this kind of tourism economy that surrounds the park. So in Grand Canyon, for example, you have this mega development that would, you know, triple the size of Tusayan, which is this sort of small town on the south rim that's being proposed and has so far been stymied. But you also have, you know, the Navajo Nation is interested in putting a gondola to from the the rim of the Grand Canyon down to the confluence of the Colorado and the Little Colorado. And then you also have, a uranium mining that is a uranium mine that is proposed to be reopened just 9 miles from the canyon rim. So there's this sort of constant pressure around the parks of people wanting to sort of get a piece of them, get a piece of the action and make money from them. And that paired with budget shortfalls, trying to sort of keep up the parks, presents this sort of existential threat to them in years going forward. And really, the way to combat that is about creating this sort of sense of engagement and ownership among future generations for the parks. And so it's about figuring out how to get fourth graders into the parks, how to get people who are into hiking or sports or running or whatever it is, to really feel a sense of ownership over the parks and to feel like it's up to them to protect them.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell reminding us of how much development goes on. And outside the parks, there's quite beautiful land as well. But there, development just goes on and on. The West, American West, she said, loses a football field size amount of land to development every 2.5 minutes in the American West. And this issue of who's going to support the parks, use them, enjoy them, find wonder in them, be prepared to have their back, also an issue. Sally Jewell saying parks need to do more to attract a diverse population.
The majority of visitors to national parks today look like me, older and whiter, which means we haven't found a way to connect with the young people of today who are more diverse, more tech savvy, and more disconnected from nature than ever before.
More disconnected from nature than ever before. I want to look at that as well. Michael in Hartwell, Georgia. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I was calling about thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling about the disparity between preservation of the resource and use of the resource for recreation. There seems to be a lot of recreational access groups pushing for additional access and additional pushes into some of the more pristine parts of the park, while there are other people that are interested in keeping the parks pristine. For instance, mountain biking has been able to push further into parks than ever before, and the kayaking groups that can really get to the small headwater streams can get into areas of the park that they weren't in before and really create a lot of damage. Now, when you look at what's going on in Yellowstone, there seems to be a big fight over this exact issue, and I'm just wondering if the people at Outside Magazine can discuss that a little bit, since they seem to be primarily focused on the experience for recreational people and less into the preserving the resource for future generations.
Yeah, I'm so glad you raised that, Michael. I mean, Grayson, let's go to that. I mean, you guys, you know, your covers, your photos, they're all about people engaging, people on bikes and rappelling and in the kayak. What about that tension and how you see it at Outside Magazine? Are you the generalissimo of the forces of deep engagement, which is a heck of a lot of fun? I totally get it. But what about the preservation mandate? Where are the boundaries of that conflict?
Yeah, and I mean, let me state right off the bat, the preservation mandate is critical. The position that we take is that it's about the sort of appropriate recreation in the right places, in the right areas, and the sort of the conflicts that the caller is talking about, in Yellowstone or the intrusion of mountain bikes. I think that, from my perspective, what I would be interested in seeing is the rolling back of, things like road construction and, use of private vehicles in national parks, promoting things like shuttle buses so that people park outside the parks and take shuttles into the parks so that the overall sort of numbers of vehicles are decreasing.
What about mountain bikes and kayaks and pinions?
That's right. But when it comes to things that have always sort of been appropriate within a wilderness ethic, floating rivers, for example, in the Grand Canyon or other small streams, that these are the types of things that we might look at or mountain biking on these new fat bikes on snowy roads where before snowmobilers had historically been allowed to snowmobile on roads in the winter and in Yellowstone, where we might be able to actually roll back some of the motorized use and be promoting some of these sort of smaller scale, slower, less popular adventure type of sports that sort of rely on the user's athleticism to get to make the journey. But at the same time, I think what your caller is talking about is legitimate. It's this idea of loving the parks to death. That if too many of us are getting backcountry permits and going into the parks, camping in sensitive areas or floating streams, in areas where, say there are endangered species or wolverines, that can have a huge negative impact. And I think that those things it's incredibly important to balance recreation with preservation. And for people who are doing these kinds of recreational activities, to sort of have the forethought and to have the sense of discipline and restraint to be able to say, look, I'd love to be in there, but actually, if too many of us are in there, this isn't something that these areas can support.
Let's pray for that. Hold that respect. Mary Ellen in Urbana, Illinois. Hi, Mary Ellen. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say very briefly that I volunteered when I was in Oregon at one of the national forests on the coast, and I have never worked with people that are so dedicated, the people that were the full-time employees, to making sure the people had a good experience, to shepherding the resources in a responsible way. It was amazing. And what concerns me is the cut in budget has also led to a cut in staff, and these people are working so hard to do so much. And
Mary Ellen, paint the picture for us. Which national forest or park were you in on the coast there? That's a beautiful coastline. What did it look like? What were they doing?
It was the Siusla National Forest, and it's where the forest meets the ocean.
Yeah.
So they had many unbelievable trails that they maintained. They had a very large cadre of volunteers, but I can't explain the beauty to you. And on my way home to Illinois, we stopped. They encouraged me to stop at the Redwood National Forest, and that is just awe-inspiring. We spent hours hiking, and I think anyone that's going through a spiritual crisis, you need to head to one of the national parks. That's what you need to do, because it's in nature. You're going to find what you're looking for.
Mary Ellen, you are wise, and you remind us of all that dedication from the National Park Service staff, and for any and all of them listening right now, we really thank you for that. But also keep watching that budget. That really matters over time, what we invest in keeping these people and these places in the shape they ought to be in. Harrison in Edgartown, Massachusetts, Martha's Vineyard. Harrison, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My wife and I are born and bred New Englanders, and we had always vacationed in the stereotypical Cape Cod and seen Mount Washington and done it. But when we were actually boyfriend and girlfriend, we took a week vacation. We decided to go to Acadia National Park in Maine, and we actually felt so connected to nature and to each other in that week, that 6 months, like within the 6 months I had proposed and we were married. We definitely attribute it to our week there.
It is totally stunning, Acadia. Just an absolutely beautiful East Coast face of the national parks. Irresistible, isn't it, Harrison?
It is. I really think it's a diamond in the rough. People don't think of New England when they think of national parks, but yet this, Acadia is there and it's absolutely beautiful.
Three cheers for that, and hope you got a beautiful marriage out of that. Jeff in Nashville, Tennessee. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. I just wanted to call about Glacier National Park. I would really encourage people to go there. If they do, they should go to the Mini Glacier Valley, where the Mini Glacier Hotel is. And there are three beautiful hikes that come out of the Mini Glacier Valley. And I actually saw a grizzly bear on one of those hikes. It's very exciting.
What was the grizzly doing, Jeff?
Well, the grizzly was actually coming towards us, and somebody else was coming in front of him. And the guy told us, there's a grizzly bear behind me. So we jumped up on a little cliff about 15 feet above the trail. The grizzly came and stood underneath us and looked at another group of tourists that we were saying, wait, stay back. And, of course, they did, because they saw the bear. And then the bear sort of evaluated the whole situation and decided to go eat some berries. Luckily for us, the other tourists decided they would go take pictures of the bear inside the berry patch, and that provided us an opportunity to walk on down the trail.
You don't have to be faster than the bear, just faster or smarter than the other folks out there. I love that, Jeff. Thanks for taking us to Montana and Glacier National. One more, Jasmine in Johnson, Vermont. Jasmine, you are on the air. Our time is short.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad to be on. I just wanted to end the show with just a short anecdote about an experience in Acadia National Park. We had driven through the park and seen people laughing and playing and hiking and just having a wonderful time for a week-long visit. But then on our last day, we went up to Cadillac Mountain for sunrise and watched this beautiful natural phenomenon with, you know, young kids on sports teams and old folks and just all different walks of life. And just how beautiful this one experience was, you know, just a very short, small portrait of humanity and how respectful everyone was while watching this beautiful, beautiful thing that happens every day, but maybe not being able to see it in any other respect than at a national park and getting that excuse to do so with you know, complete strangers was just something that I'm going to keep in my pocket for the rest of my life.
Jasmine,
I'm very thankful for that memory.
You put us right there, Jasmine, and we're thankful for that. Sunrise on a national park, people from all walks of life. That sounds like the national park story. Let's keep more people coming in there, more walks of life, more diverse people coming in to value this and take care of it. I'm so grateful to all of you from Outside Magazine with us today, Grayson Schaefer, Kate Sieber, Axine Navis, for taking us deep into the parks and the issues around them. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. And listeners, thanks for all your stories here and online and on Twitter, On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks so much for being with us today. Have a great summer wherever it is. This is On Point.